Twofootedtackle.com.
Yes, it's Two-Footed Tackle podcast time, as we finally have an answer to the question, can Barcelona do it on a cold Tuesday night in England? Meanwhile, disruption in Jordan could lead to protests elsewhere. We'll have the latest on Frida Gattuso 1 campaign. We'll also have a bit on Serie A, the Premier League, and a tribute to the original Ronaldo. All that and more on the Two-Footed Tackle podcast. Yes, hello, and welcome to the Two-Footed Tackle podcast. I'm your host, Gary Andrews, on the pod this week. First up, editor of twofootedtackle.com, Chris Nee.
Evening.
Evening. So that's quite a dramatic intro, wasn't it?
It's very grand, isn't it?
Yeah, editor. It's like X Factor style. Chris Nee is here.
I'd think myself more as a curator.
Okay, curator. I like that. That's good. How's your footballing week been?
Yeah, not too bad. I think Napoli have obviously lit it up, which we'll come on to later on. And very much looking forward to getting back to Tooting on Saturday because I've missed a few. So good to see them back at home and I'll actually be in the country.
Fantastic stuff. Joining us this week, a pod debut for the man who can give you better odds than Ray Winstone, editor of Bet of the Week, Jonathan Blessard. Hi, Blaz. Blaz, John, Blaz, Blaz.
We'll go with Blaz. Blaz. Yeah, sounds a little arrogant to come in with a nickname straight out of the gate.
Hey, you know, that's what Brazilians do. So
exactly, I am the Samba King of betting.
Fantastic. Okay, now we'll go straight into it because we've got loads to get on. The greatest competition on earth, or at least that's what we're legally obliged to call it until the next World Cup.
I genuinely saw someone refer to it as that today.
Really?
Yeah.
Fantastic. And no hint of irony at all?
No.
Wonderful.
No, justifying the prices of the final tickets.
Okay, because it was the greatest
competition in the world.
It just happens every year.
Yeah, okay. And it's quite dull.
Okay. Well, not so much. Champions League return. Obviously, we're talking about the Champions League here. Blaz, we were talking just before we came on here. It's been a brilliant week of football and two great results for English teams in Europe.
Fantastic. Fantastic week for English football. Fantastic week for me personally as a United fan to be able to enjoy the Champions League for a week and not have to kind of concern myself with what my boys are up to. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I'm not one of those fans that kind of is 100% supporting United. I did speak to a guy in the office today that came up to me and said, oh, couldn't handle the result last night. I just wish Barca had absolutely done them over. I said, what do you mean? You know, it's better for English football. It's better for Man United to have Barcelona out of the competition. This is just win-win. He wasn't having it. He just wanted to see United bust and all the English teams out. But I love to see the English teams do well.
And they didn't. They do well. Let's start off in Italy. Great result for Spurs against Milan.
Absolutely fantastic. Fantastic result. Even better performance, actually. Maybe versus the game on Wednesday night. Man for man, they were almost brilliant all across the park in my eyes. Absolutely brilliant.
And I mean, there was a concern with Spurs. We saw what happened last time in the San Siro and it really exposed. Do you think they've tightened up a bit now that they've got that further, or is it just Milan having an off night?
I'm certainly not going to make any judgments at this point. I mean, they've struggled to keep clean sheets all season. And I'll hold my hands up. I thought they were going to get opened up like a tin of beans, but they were fantastic. Even managed to get Woodgate on the pitch and still keep a clean sheet.
That's just taking the piss, isn't it, really?
Although I do hear he's managed to do his groin at some point during his 20 minutes of action. So
fantastic. Chris, on the Milan front, they were missing a lot of key players, weren't they? Could have been slightly different, although take nothing away from Spurs' performance. But if Milan had a fully fit side, because I've seen a lot of pundits sort of go overboard and go, you know, this is a great Spurs performance. And you look at the Milan team and you go, it wasn't quite their best team that they could have put out.
It wasn't quite their best team, which is an incredibly talented team with lots of big stars and a lot of quality throughout the whole team. But I actually find it difficult to take away from Spurs. Apparently the performance was excellent and you beat what's in front of you. And you know, Milan put out a team, regardless of who it is, who have a lot of quality and have enough quality to do well in the Champions League. So all credit to Spurs.
Do you think that answers some of the questions that Spurs perhaps have been accused of being quite naive in Europe this season? Do you think they've woken up a little bit?
It's possible. Let's reserve judgment until the second leg, because there is still a lot of room for naivety in this tie.
Gomez had to make a couple of key saves during the game. He had one of his better days. He's one of those guys that has his moments, good and bad, and he had a great game, made some good saves. The tie could have come out differently, but they played brilliantly, and you know, with a one goal lead going back to White Hart Lane, you've got to fancy them to get through. Actually,
it's as good as you would have hoped for them before. Absolutely. The game, but if they can see the goal, then we'll find out whether they're naive or not.
Yeah, what they're made of, indeed. Obviously, a couple of big talking points on there. We mentioned in the intro Gattuso. What was your reading of the incident, Blaz?
I've got to admit, I absolutely love it. That you know, we're still talking about it now, even after, you know, the game last night. Would we still be talking about this game? No, we wouldn't. We wouldn't be talking about it. It's absolutely my sort of thing, a bit of aggression, a bit of handbags. No one actually got hurt, which, unlike, you know, the moment in the game with Flamini's tackle. And I'm sure Joe Jordan doesn't mind either, to be honest. I'm sure they're all having a bit of a laugh about it on the training ground, and Gattuso should probably just be lucky he didn't get sparked out, to be honest.
Chris, my reading of it is always... I mean, I like Gattuso. I think he plays the pantomime villain part very well. And, you know, that was a classic panto villain performance there.
It was. I'm not going to be too... too damning on him. It was a moment, it was entertaining, it was probably unacceptable, but these things happen in football. Who will take his ban on the chin? I'm sure, as Bled says, Joe Jordan isn't going to be bothered by it in the least. So it was not good to see, but I certainly wouldn't want to see that kind of action out of the game, unlike the other incident that was mentioned.
Was that a two-footed tackle by any chance?
It was a two-footed tackle.
Ka-ching. The other game as well, anything Spurs can do, Arsenal can do better, please.
Very much so, very much so. You know, the game was obviously built up massively in the press, and they didn't let us down. It was a fantastic performance from both sides. It was a little bit like watching Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather going at it rather than two heavyweights end to end. Brilliant stuff. Enjoyed every minute of it.
Yeah, Chris, I mean, first half, I was drooling over Barcelona. I thought they looked fantastic. And, I mean, you've got to give credit to Arsenal. They really put on probably one of their best performances I think I've seen in Europe.
They did. It's starting to come into Arsenal's game a little bit, despite the Newcastle turnaround, that they now don't really know when they're beaten, even in games like this. And last year we saw that they were just completely played off the park. But even sort of 12 minutes from the end to have a turnaround like that, it was absolutely fantastic. And worth noting that they'd made a substitution with a certain Danish striker coming on before those two goals.
Yes, but he didn't actually score.
Doesn't matter.
It's all down
to Nicky B.
Funnily enough, we said that in the pub and we came on and went, right, he's probably going to get a hat-trick now because we spent the entire time just deriding Bentner. But, sorry, Chris, you're about to say.
What's your take on Van Persie's goal and the goalkeeping?
My take, I thought it was... the goalkeeper was clearly anticipating a cross to come in. He was wrong-footed, but even so, you shouldn't be caught at your near post like that.
I've got to admit,
I agree, half of that.
I'm a former goalkeeper myself. It's one of those things that actually anticipating the cross probably works out in your favour in the long run, but the one time it goes against you, you look pretty silly. It's still an incident that shouldn't really happen. The goal shouldn't go in. The tie could look very different. And unfortunately, there's a hint of realism for the Gooners out there. Without that mistake and Messi having a little moment when he missed the one-on-one in the first half, I do think the game could have unravelled.
That one-on-one, so many players miss those all the time. And I was expecting, when I heard about it and then watched the highlights, I was expecting it to be a real sitter. But I wouldn't put that away in a million years.
I'd actually like to give credit there to Chesney, the goalkeeper, because I thought he did it fantastically well. He stayed up right until the very last moment, didn't go down, made it so, so difficult. I thought he had an excellent game. Yeah. I think he's looking like a number one keeper.
Yeah, no, in the second half, he made a couple of blocks and came out and blocked balls. And I thought he had a great game as well. Great game.
But you can't write Barcelona off. They've got that goal. All they need is one back at the Nou Camp. And we know they are a fantastic team. They don't lose very often.
No, I think they're 3-1 on to win the game at the Nou Camp. And better than 2-1 on, about 1.4 to go through. So it still doesn't look great for Arsenal. But, I mean, without being rude, if they go out having won the first leg to who their captain is claiming is the greatest team in the history of football, then really you can't be that disappointed.
No, not at all, not at all. It's interesting, actually. I noticed that I think Barcelona's stutters have all come after international breaks, which is quite interesting, because they had the stutter against Sporting Gijón at the weekend as well.
Yeah.
If either of you two saw David Villa's goal for Barcelona there, it's worth checking out on YouTube. It's a sublime little lob that will just have you drooling into your... into your laptop or whatever that you're watching it on at the time. A few other ones as well. Valencia-Schalke drawing is perhaps one that hasn't had too much attention there, but, you know, it's still to play for in that one.
Very much all to play for. I didn't see the full game. I saw the highlights. Fantastic goal from Raul. A typical Raul goal, really. Initially, looks like there's nothing to it, and then you watch his movement on the replay, and he nips in front of the defender, and then a nice left-footed finish into the corner. It's old school Raul and very, very nice goal and sets it up perfectly now for the second leg.
I wouldn't like to call that one at all. Schalke, one of the most unpredictable sides, I think, at the moment in the Bundesliga. Now, Chris, I suspect it would have been better if we'd had James here for this one. Roma against Shakhtar. But I wasn't entirely surprised to see Roma lose that game, even though they're at home.
No, I wasn't surprised either, having seen their previous home game against a certain southern Italian rival. So not a shock at all. I think, you know, 3-2 is really quite a poor result for a home team in Europe. They're really going to have to go some to turn that round. Interesting to see those Ukrainian names scoring for Shakhtar.
Yes, Douglas Costa, Luis Adriano. Shakhtar are, I mean, from the little I've seen of them, they're a very, very tight, difficult side. One that you wouldn't fancy. Obviously, you remember them from the UEFA Cup a couple of years ago. They are a difficult side to beat, and they just happen to be coming in a little bit ring rusty, coming in off the back of their sort of winter break. But, you know, good side.
They are a good side. I think that difficulty to beat them will probably do Roma no favours in the second leg. I can't see them winning it by enough, to be honest, because having seen them a couple of times recently, I just don't think they're good enough.
Still some great fixtures to look forward to next week. Just have a quick preview. United against Marseille. We've had quite a few French football fans come on the pod before. They all rate Marseille quite highly. What's your take on how you think United might do, Blaise?
Overall in the tie, I'm going to risk an absolute schoolboy here by saying I'm not too concerned. In the first leg, however, they're a very strong home team. I think they've lost once at home in the league all season. And in good form at the moment. Haven't lost for quite a while, so I'd be more than happy to get out of their level and then take them back to Old Trafford, which we've done over the years, and normally that system's come out quite well, so I'd be delighted with a 1-1 draw now.
There's another fascinating tie, so I mean Chelsea-Copenhagen is probably the least interesting one, but Copenhagen, they caused Barca a few problems, but I guess you can't see anything other than Chelsea.
I can't see anything other than a Chelsea win. Rather than the result at the moment, I'm just more interested in to see which players Chelsea put on the pitch and where they line up. This whole idea of playing Anelka in behind in the hole, I'm not convinced by whatsoever, and I think that experiment's got to end pretty quickly if they're going to get back into the title race or look to progress to the latter stages of this competition. I can't see that working.
And a couple of other very good fixtures left in there. Inter against Bayern, rerun of the final, and Real Madrid against Lyon.
Yeah, Inter starting to come into a little bit of form despite their latest result, and Bayern
are coming into a bit of form.
Yeah,
as
so
well,
they got turned are. Over by Cologne, didn't they, in that second half? But there's 4-0 over Hoffenheim last weekend. So
they did their usual really slow start to the season. Yeah. You know, ended up X number of points behind. They've left it too late to catch Dortmund now in the Bundesliga, but you know they're going to end up finishing second. I would very much expect.
I would say that Inter-Bayern is probably the tie of next week, if you're looking for any of them.
Definitely. It's
the one that is going to be the most fascinating and the tightest to call.
So, Robin and Ribery played together, didn't they? I think Terry said it was for the first time this season, which is quite remarkable.
And it's a frightening thought if you're Inter.
Certainly is, particularly as you know they proved on Sunday that they are beatable.
Well, seeing as we're talking about Italian sides, focus on them quite a lot, I thought now's as good a time as any to talk Serie A. Let's just rewind briefly back to Roma. A few weeks ago, Chris, they were being talked as potential Scudetto champions. After losing to Napoli, we're now discussing the potential sacking of Ranieri, especially after that midweek Champions League result.
Yeah, very poor results in quick succession for Ranieri, and they haven't won in three in the league. So the Scudetto battle, if it was there for them at all, is pretty much gone now. There are just too many teams above them, and they're not all going to collapse. And they look distinctly unimpressive. They were a little bit chippy. They completely lost their discipline against Napoli. And as they showed in midweek, they shipped goals as well. So probably a worrying time for Ranieri. I like to think he won't lose his job quite so quickly. But that's football, and that's Italian football. So I think it's entirely possible that they will get rid. But I don't know what they're expecting. The new manager bounce doesn't win you Scudettos.
It's a very strange time to decide to change manager, you know, in February.
They're not going down.
In between the legs as well, I mean, are you going to get a bounce that's going to get you a result in the Ukraine? You know, that'd be a bit of a controversial decision in my eyes. I expect him to stay.
Yeah, and the other thing I think possibly in Ranieri's favour just about is the situation of the club is so uncertain, whether they're going to sell it or not. Chances are the old owner's probably not going to sack him, because if they got new people in, they'll just wait for the new guys to do it, and you know, can take responsibilities there from. But yeah, sad times for Roma, good times for Napoli though, Chris. And genuine question: they're only 3 points behind Milan. Can they win the Scudetto? Yes.
Yes.
Why?
Because I really want them to.
That's not a good enough reason.
Honestly, I think Milan are probably just about too good and too consistent for Napoli to win the league. But if they keep going the way they are, they're going to be right in touch. And it's just those results, it's the drop in the points against the likes of Chievo that they've done twice this season, that will hamstring them. And hopefully a good run in the Europa League might make it a bit tricky as well.
This is you've gone all Italian on say, because you started doing the hand gestures as well when you were talking about it. It's got under your skin that much.
I've started doing that since working with basically lots of people who aren't English.
Okay, you get the hand gestures and everything on
the whole world seems to have inherited Napoli as their second favourite team. It's not just this room or this podcast. I don't think that I see them at work. I you know, all over the internet. The whole world seems to love Napoli.
They are very lovable, and I'm proud to say that I've been following them for a number of years.
Do you expect them to finish second this season?
I expect them to now, yeah. I will be disappointed if they don't, because I think that they have an awful lot of quality. And I guess that the three games that they are going to be missing the Betsy for will tell.
Just a very brief couple of more things on Napoli, because we don't talk about them that often, but hey, you know, why not? Cannavaro's cross for Cavani's goal against Roma. What a ball that was. Especially given he's a centre-half as well.
Yeah, and not the most cultured centre-half in the world either. The penalty was my favourite goal of that game. It was the weirdest penalty I've ever seen.
What happened?
Well,
describe it.
Also, Cavani took the penalty and it hit the post, rolled sort of along the goal line, hit the other post, came back and he put it in, which he's not allowed to do. Cue confusion, but the replay showed that it had crossed the line initially anyway, so there was like lots of different
hand gesturing.
Loads of hand gesturing. Loads of ways in which the whole situation was wrong, and it hadn't crossed the line, and he put it in after it had come off the post, and then lots of talk about the furniture of the game, and it would be the same if it hit the referee and all of that nonsense. But it went in anyway, so
doesn't matter. I heard actually, I don't know if this is true, but I heard that they were 66-1 at the start of the season to win the Scudetto Napoli.
Sounds about right.
Hell of a bet if anybody's put money on that.
It's a hell of a bet each way, but it's a losing bet, I think, come the end of the season.
I think you're right.
Irrespective, unfortunately. It would make a great story. I mean, it's only 2 years ago they were probably finished in the bottom half. I think it was 11th, 12th, something around there.
And after a good season. So they tend to, you know, they have a good one, they push for Europe, they drop a bit, they're inconsistent, and they've gone through Eddie Reyes' time, finished relatively badly, and then Donadoni was just an absolute shambles, and Walter Mazzarri has really got his head screwed on. So pretty good time to be a Napoli fan at the moment.
Good to see him on a Tuesday and Wednesday night next year.
Absolutely. Third place, Inter. They've had a little bit of a revival under Leonardo, but as been pointed out in many other places this week, they lost to Juve, and Leonardo's record as a manager against the big teams in Italy is not particularly good.
No, it's not, and he's I suppose a little bit hamstrung by his team at Milan wasn't that great and got absolutely turned over by Inter a couple of times. So I'd suggest possibly slightly too young a manager to be judging your sort of long term records against different types of club. But those big games are going to be crucial, and that's one of the reasons why I, to be honest, expect Napoli now to finish second. But Inter are going to be right up there with them. And they might well do a good job in Europe as well. But
it makes for a very exciting end to the season, though, in Italy, doesn't it? Especially given that our usual one of Germany is now looking more and more like a procession.
For first, certainly. It's even, you know, the top three is 6 points, 5 points even. So it's tight enough for it to be open in terms of the titles. Second and third are definitely up for grabs, and even the European spots are wide open, so it's a fantastic league to watch. The quality of the football is excellent, and there are a few characters in there worth watching as well, a lot of them in red and black.
And do you think that Juve might be one of those clubs that might actually miss out on a European spot? Because they've had a very up and down season. They look decent against Inter, but every time I've seen them look good, they've had one good game, two bad games.
Yeah, over the years, I've seen a lot of average Juventus sides who've really been able to turn it on against the likes of Milan and Inter, and haven't really been able to do it against a lot of the teams around them. So I certainly wouldn't be surprised to see them miss out. But if you look at the teams below them, it's difficult to see anybody of those in Europe. They've got Palermo, Roma, Cagliari. And to be honest, I don't think any of those are particularly that, you know, they're not great shakes themselves. So they might just sneak in by default, Juve, but it certainly won't be on the fact that they're European quality. No. At their best, as we saw on Sunday, that, you know, they do have that there.
Great to see Udinese up there as well.
Yeah.
I like them. I think they're slightly, they're a very entertaining team.
Yeah.
Nothing else.
The Italian league to me is feeling a little bit like the French league at the moment, in that these teams can come from kind of like, you know, lower top half and make a move into the top five, which obviously is something we generally don't see in this country. And it's been a bit more common in, you know, in France, yeah, over the last few years. But I mean, you know, we're saying okay, we can't see certain clubs in Europe, but I mean, you know, if you look at the table, I mean, with, you know, with so few games to go, it only takes a run of four or five games, and someone could well be appearing in Europe next year. So
true, and without spending big money as well.
I'm sure if Napoli do get through and draw one of the London teams in the Champions League, Chris will be there like a flash.
You won't see me for dust.
Indeed not. Okay, we'll leave Serie A there, like you'll see Chris, yeah, running around. Let's head back to more familiar shores after the break. We're going to be going to the Premier League, and that's coming up after this. Welcome back, part two of the Two Footed Tackle podcast. Another fascinating weekend in the Premier League. The obvious bit out the way first, something everybody's been talking about. I'm nearly a little bit bored of it, but it was so good, you can't not mention it. So, Blaise, Rooney's win at United in the Manchester derby.
Very nice. It was obviously a fantastic goal. I think it's been overdone a little bit in the media with the whole the goal of the season awards all over. Personally, I'm more of a fan of a well-constructed team goal or a long-range screamer, to be honest. But no, fantastic technique and a great goal, but he owes us a couple more of those before he's off scot-free in my eyes.
Do you think he had a particularly good game or not? Because I thought he was sporadic.
He did what he's been doing all season. He always works hard, and that's why he can get away with being a little bit out of form and still contribute massively to the team, because he's always going to give you that commitment. But his touch is a little bit off at the moment. His interplay with anyone other than Berbatov is a little bit off, but I think, you know, even amateur footballers can look nice playing with Berbatov. He's that sort of player. He's not quite on it, but he's more than worthy of his place in the team still, I mean.
And that goal was the difference deserved for Manchester United?
I think it was, just about. We were very disciplined and structured as usual. It's quite amazing, actually, how the individual components of the team can change from week to week, and the performance doesn't really alter. Rio seems to play once every 6 months these days, to be honest, and it does mean we concede a few more goals than we were doing in the last couple of seasons. But aside from that, you know, the team's ticking over quite well, to be honest.
And Manchester City 1-1, Mancini, he would have been happy, I guess, by his demeanour on the touchline.
Yeah, I think so. I think they've got a pretty specific aim this season, and that's to get in the Champions League for next season. I don't actually think they're trying to win the league this year. I don't think he was challenged with that, and I don't think he's trying to do that. I mean, I think the way he set himself up in the first game against United and at the Emirates, he's more than happy to take a point away from home against the big guys, and obviously they're dealing with the poor teams at home very easily, and I think they're going to canter into the Champions League.
And it could have been different though had David Silva got a goal very early on.
Could have been very different, a bit like the game last night, to be honest, at the Emirates. That, you know, if Messi sticks that early chance away, the whole thing could unravel. If David Silva sticks that away, honestly, you know, they can get a 1-0 with the best of them with that team. I thought Kompany was awesome again. I think I saw the guys not missed a minute of football all season, actually. And you know, they get a lot of coverage. Silva, Tevez, all those players, but for me, Vincent Kompany's their player of the season and one of the kind of top 10 players probably in the Premier League this season, actually.
Chris, with that result, I know it's still quite a long way to go in the season, a bit premature, but is it now down between Manchester United and Arsenal for the title?
Yeah, it is, and I think that United are pretty much nailed on now as well. Arsenal have, as I said earlier, a little bit more about them than they have done in previous seasons. But I think your assertion that they will be looking at next season, I think that's probably pretty much on the nose. United have been, you know, they've looked beatable at the same time as not being beaten for large periods of this season. But I can't see them losing enough to get caught by City now, and Arsenal, you know, 4 points is a lot to overturn at this stage, particularly with United getting those points regardless almost of how they're playing.
It was a big big win for Arsenal as well, coming back off their 4-4 last week against Newcastle. It's time. Wolves, we've seen what Wolves can do to some very good teams, but Mick McCarthy said they got a spanking at the end of that.
He did. It's almost a shame not to see Wolves get all four, isn't it, really? Robin van Persie is carrying them through a couple of games on their own. You know, they've got a lot of great players who are helping him do it, but you know, he's putting the ball in the back of the net and staying injury free for the most part as well. So he's a huge player for them. I think most of us knew he would be if he could stay on the pitch, and he's really coming into his own at the moment, both domestically and in Europe. So he's a huge player for them.
I think if van Persie could stay on the pitch, he'd probably already be playing in Spain. So actually, it's probably to their benefit that he's injury prone.
And in terms of Spurs as well, getting a good win, keeping themselves in contention for that fourth Champions League spot as well.
Yeah, they've got a very decent shout. It pains me to say it, but they are a very good side, and they, you know, it's not tactical genius, and it's nothing clever about it. They've just amassed a lot of very good players. They play attacking football, and they go out and beat teams off the pitch. So you know, it's mixed feelings on Spurs, because they are pretty to watch. But at the same time, it's difficult to see Harry Redknapp getting the plaudits for something that's actually just, you know, a lot of very good players assembled at a high price.
And you've got to say, players, that very much helped by Chelsea, who are looking worse and worse by the week. Now, you didn't even manage to last through Chelsea against Fulham.
I didn't, no. I handed the remote back to my girlfriend, actually, after about an hour. And just said, to be honest, I can't really be bothered with this. It would seem like a bit of a waste of my evening at the time.
And it was a waste of my evening as well, other than the last 5 minutes.
I'm not buying into this system of let's take our best seven midfielders and forwards and put them all on the pitch at the same time in any position. I don't think Nicolas Anelka, as a kind of behind the strikers, you know, third of the front three, I don't think he's in the top 30 in Europe in that position, and I don't think many people would argue with that. And to expect to win the Premier League or the Champions League using him in that way, that's just not going to work. So the quicker Ancelotti decides tactically what he's going to do, the better, I think, from their perspective.
And to me, they didn't really trouble Fulham at all. Fulham looked comfortable, if not particularly adventurous.
Yeah, because they're too narrow, and then they've got three forward players that obviously haven't played together, and it's not their fault. And I don't want this to sound like a slight on Nicolas Anelka at all. I think he's a great player, and he's managed to play the, you know, either a role up front or a role in the right hand channel fantastically well for them. But to suddenly, I saw it described in the newspaper the other day as Nicolas Anelka's playing in the Kaká position, and to compare Nicolas Anelka and Kaká, that just doesn't work for me personally.
Yeah, oranges and apples, yeah, and all that. Chris, one of the results, or one of the games of the weekend, probably has to be West Brom against West Ham. What on earth would Scott Parker have been saying in the dressing room? Credit to West Ham there for hauling themselves back in from what would have been, you know, looking like a relegation definite to probably still going to go down, but giving themselves a little bit more hope.
Yeah, well, I hope he was saying your defending was rubbish, because that is pretty much the story of the first half, and both teams defended absolutely shockingly. Early goals from West Brom, so yeah, that you can come back from 2-0 down after 8 minutes if it's your day. But 3-0 at half time is a Newcastle-esque turnaround in that match, and crucial goals from Demba Ba, particularly the one just after half time. And worth praising Graham Dorrance for his strike as well, particularly so soon after kickoff.
Absolutely.
Good player, Graham Dorrance.
With West Ham as well, it's obviously very tight down the bottom, but do you think this side is better or worse than the side, previous West Ham side, that was too good to go down, that contained the likes of Carrick and Defoe and that lot?
I think they're worse, or I think that they have a better chance of staying up, bizarrely.
I think this side's very much a comparable side to the team that did it last year, and personally I expect exactly the same result. I think West Ham are going to stay up. I've been kind of looking at it on the basis that one of those teams at the bottom needs to win two games running, and if they do, they're probably going to stay up. And when I look at Wigan and I look at Wolves and I look at West Ham, the team that I can see winning two games running is West Ham. The options they've got up front, they've actually got five players that most Premiership teams would be happy to play up front. So although they seem to be a little bit cavalier at the moment and incapable of keeping the ball out, they've just got too much talent up front to go down in my eyes. But I've been saying that for about 6 weeks now, and it's not happened yet, so I'm starting to get a bit edgy on that one.
Well, one side who deserves credit is Newcastle. Four points
from two very tricky away games. Away at Blackburn, where apparently they played Blackburn off the park, which doesn't happen at Ewood very often. Came away with a point there, and then a great 3 points, comfortably beating Birmingham, which certainly doesn't happen at St Andrews very often. So those, they're big 4 points that they were probably only expecting. They'd have been delighted with three and probably happy with two. So,
And I mean, it just goes, although they haven't really got a strike force now, goes straight that what a turnaround like the Arsenal game can do. That looks like a side that actually believes that they're able to play and they're able to get a result wherever they're going now.
I think so. I think Joey Barton's a top half Premier League midfielder. I think Kevin Nolan is probably comparable, and you know, the guy Tiote, he's getting linked with all and sundry, and you know, over the next year or two. So they've got players in that team that can more than hold their own in the middle of this division, I realised early season that they weren't going down. Quite how high up they can finish now with how tight the league is, I'm not sure, actually.
And another reasonably big name, Chris, but Everton look like they're starting to slip back. They're very close to the bottom three. And David Moyes seemed absolutely bewildered, furious after their loss at the weekend. Are they genuinely in a relegation fight, or are they too good to go down, or are they just, you know, a blip and they will be back up again?
They're about to be in a relegation fight. I think that's almost a certainty. I really expect them to drop. Earlier in the season, losing 2-0 at Bolton wouldn't have been a surprise particularly, but Everton going there and doing it at this stage is a little bit of a shocker. And it's with what we're going to come on to in part three, it's hardly surprising to see David Moyes isn't the happiest bunny at the moment. And he's had seasons where they've been like this, and he's had seasons where they've been brilliant. But he's been there a long time now, and it's probably starting to get a little bit frustrating that he hasn't at any point really been able to push on from those successful seasons.
I actually thought that I'm going to agree with you and disagree with you there on that one, Chris. I thought they were going to go to Bolton and come away with at least a point, actually. I thought it was almost going to be a little mini turning point in their season that they then push on and look to finish kind of in those 6th, 7th, 8th places they're expected to finish. And they were poor and deservedly got beat, but I don't think they'll get dragged into a relegation battle. Not because I've got great faith in Everton over the rest of the season, but I just think some of the other teams down there are poor enough that Everton won't get dragged into it.
Chris, Villa, drawing, anything you want to say about that?
Poor performance, poor result, moving on. Terrible tackle from John McCoon.
Get two-footed?
Not quite as bad as Flamini, but it was two-footed and deservedly sent off. Yeah.
Important point for Blackpool, though.
Every point is important for Blackpool.
Every point. Got some horrible fixtures in the last kind of 10-12 games. Horrible fixtures.
Although a lot of them at home.
I think they finished the season with a little game at Old Trafford, so they might want to hope that the season doesn't go down to the wire for both clubs, because that would not leave them in a favourable position on the last day.
And every point's important for Blackpool, every point's important for Wigan, and they got a very good point against Liverpool.
Excellent point that I really didn't see coming, to be honest. I'd started to buy into the brainwashing of Kenny is the saviour of all things, and that they were maybe even going to nick fourth place from nowhere. Thankfully, that weaker moment in my life is now over, and I'm quite happy that they're going to be finishing somewhere around 6th or 7th in the league.
Thing I want to say about Liverpool specifically, Raul Morelos, he got a lot of stick when he first arrived. He looks really like a player who's now acclimatised to Premier League.
A Roy Hodgson signing as well, it should be noted that he got a lot of stick, and they're now happy to, you know, praise Kenny for the turnaround, but it is one of Hodgson's signings that's doing the business for them. He looks a fantastic player.
He is, and he's been a fantastic player for a while as well. So, you know, it's to see him get the criticism he did, you know, maybe that the whole club was just a complete mess for a lot of the time under Hodgson. and not necessarily because of the manager. So the excuse will be he wasn't deployed properly, but he is a superb player, and it's hardly surprising at all to see him doing well now.
Chelsea win aside, and I'll give massive credit to Kenny for that. He raised the players hugely for that performance, but the Chelsea win aside, I think they get almost identical results under Hodgson. I mean, they won at Wolves. You know, they got beat at Blackpool right at the start of Dalglish's reign. I mean, it's not like they've been on an absolute tear, apart from the Chelsea game. You know, huge credit for pulling off that result. That was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. I often wonder what things would have been like if they kept with Hodgson and got exactly the same results. I think there would be an impotent fury coming from the Kop. On to another subject which isn't quite on the pitch, but just want to quickly mention the Olympic Stadium. The decision has been sort of made, hasn't quite been rubber stamped yet. West Ham given preference over Spurs. What do you make of it, Blaise?
I'd rather that West Ham got the stadium and Spurs stayed where they are. I think that's better for the kind of heritage of English football. I wasn't overly comfortable with them appearing in Stratford and playing there. What concerns me is, I don't know, hopefully someone will correct me, you know, if this isn't the case, but my understanding is that West Ham still keep that stadium even if they go down, and I'm a little bit uncomfortable at West Ham versus Doncaster on a Tuesday night in January. And that stadium being rather empty and the whole thing kind of falling a little bit flat. So
according to Karen Brady in The Sun, that'll be fine. It'll be packed to the rafters. Everybody will be eating their pie and mash on the way to the ground, and Harry Redknapp will have won the World Cup with England. Chris.
Free porn for everybody.
No, I'm going to stop what I'm going to say there because that would get me in a lot of trouble. Chris, Orient have launched, or say they're going to put together a complaint that it breaches Premier League rules, it breaches Football League rules, that they're going to seek it. Do you think that they've got a case, or, you know, is it just the case of West Ham were simply the best option, and it's kind of not really West Ham's fault that the Olympics have left it so long for that?
No, it's not West Ham's fault. I don't really approve of the decision, but it's certainly not West Ham's fault. And Orient have probably left it a little bit late, would you say, in final.
Well, what else could they have done?
Their concerns are completely justified, and you know, I tend to stay on top of a lot of the football stuff, and it's only really started to come to the fore in the last few months that Orient have been kind of unhappy about it. But you can't just put a Premier League team on a League One, hopefully still, League One team's doorstep. You can't do it. And if it does breach rules, then, you know, nothing will be done, of course. But we'll all know what's happened.
Because West Ham says, you know, they'll give out cheaper tickets to the community and stuff like that. And you actually look at an overhead shot, and it's easily walking distance. You know,
I've done it.
You've done it. How long?
10 minutes.
If they scheduled the games, maybe have West Ham as a lunchtime kickoff, 3 o'clock for Leyton Orient. They could all sort of buy one, get one free, wander along, two different games in one day. Perfect. But that's probably not going to happen.
Radical idea throw out there. Why don't we use the Olympic Stadium for athletics?
Pretty much fundamentally against giving stadiums, whether they're free or subsidised or whatever, to football clubs who operate in a competitive environment. It completely devalues the level playing field theory behind the game.
If West Ham step and they do get the stadium, I mean, is that going to help with their financial situation? Because they're not doing particularly well off the pitch financially.
I think they're a club that can fill the stadium, and there aren't that many. You know, it would be nice to see a Leyton Orient or someone, you know, get that opportunity, but the chances of them actually filling that stadium are, you know, obviously slim. It is going to help. All these ground moves, I think, it's been proven, you know, with the clubs that have done it across Europe with other stadiums, it has positives and negatives. And more often than not, actually, these moves haven't come out too favourably for the clubs that have taken them up. So I'd be nervous if I was a West Ham fan.
Okay, right, West Ham fans, and I know there are several out there who do listen. Love to hear your opinions on that podcast at Two Footed Tackle if you want, and we'll read some of them out in a couple of weeks' time when we're back on podding. Okay, we'll stick with Premier League clubs in part three. We're leaving the football behind, sticking kind of on the financial side, because we're getting down and dirty into the mucky world of off-the-field finance. part three of the Two for the Tackle podcast with Gary Andrews, Chris Nee and Jonathan Blessard. Before we start on to our main thing, I'd just like to bring up something which from the weekend. I went to Bromley against Staines. It was a terrible game. Staines won 1-0. But notable for Bromley have an amazing bar and they have a speciality, which is not a pie at a football game. They have the biggest sausage roll you will ever see. It's about as big, it's actually bigger than the microphone that we record on there. And it takes you sort of two big towels to wipe off all the grease from you afterwards. It's absolutely fantastic. I was just wondering, Chris, what your favourite non-pie snack you've had at a football ground was?
I think for weird, earthy nostalgia, I might go for the crinkle cut chips at Godalming that come out of the oven.
Oh, fantastic.
Proper chips. Almost.
Amazing.
I don't know about any others, really. I don't mind a sausage roll, actually, at football, but I haven't had any as dramatic as that.
Trust me, Bromley sausage, they're homemade as well. They're not even bought in. They actually were chatting to them beforehand, go, have you got any sausage rolls? Go, I just made them, just put them in the oven for you. That is some service at Bromley.
Sausage roll is a winner, definitely a winner.
In general, I'm more a burger man than a pie man at football, unless the Balti pie is of sufficient quality.
Yeah. Fair enough. Are you a pie or a sausage roll or a burger man, John?
I'm a pre-match burger man, actually. Probably related to the pre-match lager. I can't resist on the way in. I would say, I remember a few years ago, I don't think it's the case anymore, at Old Trafford we had a little stage where we had potato and meat pies rather than meat and potato due to the very low quantities of meat that were actually in them. I think they were enforced to rebrand them as potato and meat.
They could have gone down to Forest Green Rovers. They could ship them down. For anybody who's listening, has no idea what the reference to Forest Green Rovers have banned meat from their pies and everything else,
and their players' diets.
Was this purely a publicity stunt, or is this
more than likely?
Is it?
The guy is a fairly committed. Their owner is a fairly committed eco warrior type person.
It's a nice trick, though, isn't it?
It is. It certainly gets in the lock, but yeah.
Gazza will be in charge within 6 months.
Chomping on a lentil burger as he goes into work. Okay, right, let's go to something which the pies all feed into, football finance. It does form match day revenue and all that. But what I was quite interested, several clubs over the last few weeks, they've been steadily releasing their results, financial results from the past year or so. And there's been some really quite interesting stuff come out of there, and we're probably only just about going to skim the surface because it's quite a big issue. And the likes of Chelsea, Everton, Sunderland have all posted losses. Now, Blaise, your day job is in finance, so...
For your sins, yes. You
probably have a slightly better understanding of some of this than we do, but it is quite striking just how big some of these losses are. And even at clubs such as Everton, which are supposedly quite a well-run club, yet they post fairly huge losses.
They are. The first kind of precursor to this piece I would probably give from a business point of view is that, yes, football clubs are a business, and obviously in the modern world we're trying to run them much more efficiently, and you know, and all the driving the revenue and the marketing and all those things are much more in focus, but it's never going to be a straight kind of comparison to the other business world, because it's a mixture of business and pleasure, so to speak, that there are always going to be people prepared to pump money in. It may not be to the scale of an Abramovich, you know, or a Sheikh Mansour that are literally going to pump in hundreds of millions of pounds, but if you had the opportunity to buy a stake in or the whole of a local football team, you know, that is a lot of people's dreams. And as a result, you know, if they have to put in a few hundred thousand pounds or a couple of million pounds, that you're going to get those people prepared to do that, and therefore football can actually sustain losses at a level that a normal business can't. Unfortunately, in recent years, we've had numerous people, it seems, buying into or buying the whole of football clubs in the UK that maybe are on a little bit of a flyer, so to speak, and don't actually even have the wealth behind them that they require. But the whole thing maybe needs to be scaled, well, certainly needs to be scaled down, but it's never going to be a kind of wealth-creating or zero-sum game in my eyes. So that's a slightly odd businessy twist on there for me.
Well, let's look at a few sort of individual examples. You've got Everton, they made a £22 million loss. They would have made a £22 million loss, had they not sold Lescott. It turned out £3.1 million. Now, they've been calling out for investment for a while. they've not actually sort of gone forward, you feel, but they've not sort of moved anywhere, but they've ended up, because of the Premier League, what it is, going backwards. Can you see them sort of turning that around without investment at all?
See, I've read numerous things, actually, particularly, you know, from Bill Kenwright and other people connected to the club saying, you know, we can't get any investment. They've just had £25 million of investment from Sheikh Mansour. I mean, they've given them a player that's probably worth somewhere between £8 and £12 million, and he's basically just invested £17 million in Everton Football Club, so they should be absolutely delighted with that one. No, Everton are, joking aside, Everton are a club I'm a big Everton fan, actually. I like the way they work. I like anyone with a Scottish manager. It seems to be a trend for me. And they've had that big cash input there from Lescott, and you know, it seems silly, but it's only 7 years since they also got the big windfall from the Rooney sale, and their transactions that aren't going to come around every 5, 6, 7 years. You look at their squad now, they haven't got any assets like a Rooney or a Lescott that are now going to go. Arteta, yes, you could obviously, you know, raise a pretty decent fee. Cahill's too old to warrant such a fee these days. They've got Rodwell and obviously Coleman coming through, but are they going to be £20 to £25 million players? Possibly, but I don't see it, and I don't see where their next big windfall's coming from.
And Chris, I mean, that all feeds back into frustration. We've seen we talked about David Moyes being frustrated in the last part. It's obvious to see when you look at exactly how much Everton haven't spent in the last few years.
But they've spent a reasonable amount of money on players over the years, but it does seem to have dried up a little around the same time that they've been selling these big players for big fees. So it doesn't seem to be that they're quite selling to buy. They're sort of selling to deal with losses, and then at times they have just invested in order to bring in the likes of Yakubu and Andy Johnson. For me, the sad thing about Everton is that they're one of the clubs, and we're going to talk about a few, and they're the one that is just dealing with the reality of being in the Premier League. There isn't really, you know, mismanagement or chasing the dream or any of that. It's just that they are dealing with life in the Premier League, where everybody else is chasing the dream or is, you know, can afford the dream. And as a result, as you say, they're going backwards.
I mean, another club as well, take for example Sunderland. They are doing very well in the table at the moment. Recorded a loss before tax of £27.9 million.
Yeah, I mean, and that's probably not even that big a number by Premier League terms, which is scary to think, really. But you know, that they're obviously they're lucky enough to have someone prepared to, you know, put money into the club on a semi regular basis. I think he's put some more money in, actually.
£19 million loan, yeah, in there, which
you know, and it's a scary thought. They're probably one of the more stable clubs in the Premier League. And they're running up losses like that.
Does it make you think that, you know, a club like Sunderland or pretty much any other club other than those which have a slightly different model or, you know, bit more even stabler than that, or have owners with bottomless pits? I mean, to me, it seems like you're almost going on a precipice and it just takes one bad thing and that whole house of cards could come down.
I mean, let's get this straight. The big clubs are not necessarily, you know, in any better position than a Sunderland or an Everton. The situation at United obviously is well documented. Everyone's aware what could or couldn't happen there over the next few years. Abramovich, I don't see him leaving Chelsea. But you know, when you're so dependent on one individual, you know, you're not in a secure position. It's not a secure position to be in. The same's now the case. For City, Liverpool have obviously had all their turmoil over the last few years. There's only one of the big teams, you know, in the Premier League that is on a secure financial footing, and obviously that's Arsenal.
Chris, let's mention Chelsea there. I mean, their losses are quite eye-watering. Obviously, they've got Abramovich behind them. I mean, interesting to see how they've managed to comply with UEFA's rules. Should UEFA actually decide to properly enforce them? Which is
should
a question
UEFA
in
decide
itself.
To enforce them? Yeah, we'll see. A little bit of spin. You know, you sent around some light reading for my train journey home,
which I'm sure you thanked me for,
which I was incredibly grateful for. And unsurprisingly, the press releases that they put out about their results are positive, but actually some of the numbers don't quite add up. And it simply, for me as a fan rather than an expert, comes down to whether Abramovich is going to sustain his involvement or not. And I think, is it right that he's got trust stuff involved for if and when he leaves? Because that's, you know, that if ever you have a bit of a cheeky pop at Chelsea and say when he goes you're buggered, they always say that he's secured their future for if he goes. But that's going to be crucial if he does, because the numbers don't stack up.
Mm. And okay, well, there's other ones as well on that. I want to ask you two about your own particular clubs. Manchester United, you've mentioned there. I mean, it's a really interesting situation what you've got, because on one hand, they have a fantastic capacity for turning over the money. They make a lot of money from match day revenue.
Yeah, and our kind of wages to turnover ratio is one of the best in the Premier League, and we're managing to keep that under control. I'm a little bit concerned to hear about the kind of amount of money people like Berbatov are going to receive on their extensions. But generally, I think we're in the top five in the Premier League on that metric, which is a great sign. The impact on United, rather than being an immediate structural risk, is the cost to the club because of the high interest rates involved in some of the products that were used to finance their deal and the Glazer deal. And to be honest, it looks like it's not taking an impact, but I think how it's going to take a hold if it does is more, not to rile any Liverpool fans, but we could see the quality of the squad deteriorate gradually over time, because we won't get those investments that we've made regularly. You know, things like the Rio Ferdinand deal, there are a lot of money. You need the money to be able to make those deals, but actually if you look at that over a 10-year period of what he's given to the club, you know, it's great value to make those deals if you want to compete in the Champions League. And if we're going to push it too hard and try and bring through a youth team player that's not quite ready here, we don't have coverage for a player off the bench there, suddenly you end up finishing third, fourth, and as Liverpool are now looking at, you don't get in the Champions League for a sudden, and then the entire Man United business model almost goes bust if we don't get into the Champions League. So we're not at a kind of risk of insolvency like, you know, for the smaller clubs, but it's what the drain on the resources of the club could be long term.
And Chris, what's your feeling on Villa? Because you've got Randy Lerner in there. He's your benefactor model again over there. You know, they're obviously a club that's now spent a fair bit in the transfer mm-hmm. window as well. It'd be really interesting in a couple of years to actually start looking at their financial position. How confident are you on your own club's financial position?
More confident than I was a few months ago, and more confident than I was a year ago, certainly. I'm going to come out fighting in favour of Lerner, because he's had a lot of questions asked of him, because he's not that forthcoming in the media about whether he's investing properly in the club and that he's not going to help us push on and everything. And a lot of that comes from the expectations that every club has, that you have to keep moving forwards. Actually, we're not really going to get into the top four anytime soon. And as we've discussed many times on this podcast, I don't really care about fourth. If you're going to win, go for first and accept fourth as a consolation. Aiming for fourth is just wrong on every level. But for some people, if you're not spending the money that needs to be done to get that fourth spot, then the owner isn't investing properly. Actually, Randy Lerner has put huge amounts of money into the club for transfers, primarily, and around the infrastructure as well. And it's a much better club than it was when he took over. And actually, Martin O'Neill has to take a lot of the blame for wasting a lot of that money. It's hardly surprising that the investment in the playing staff dried up a little bit towards the end of his time at the club, because I certainly wouldn't have given him any more money to piss up the wall either. But the numbers are quite high. We've spent an awful lot of money lately, and our wage to turnover ratio was really starting to skyrocket towards the end of that time. And you know, unconfirmed reports would be that was the sticking point, was when the Lerner, who has to take some responsibility for potentially being a little bit naive and allowing O'Neill to take on this completely running the club model, and letting that wage bill get too high, and he should have kept a lid on it himself and not allowed that to happen. Having spotted it, it seems as if he decided to stop that happening, and that may or may not be one of the reasons behind O'Neill leaving. But it certainly seems to be in better shape now, because those players that were being paid, and actually, you know, the transfer fees for those weren't exactly minimal either, are being moved on. And in the January transfer window, we brought in Michael Bradley on loan, John McCune and and Darren Bent for quite a lot of money, but actually it's the players that left that are going to be of the biggest financial benefit to the club, because they were taking wages and, you know, not performing in both senses of the word because they weren't even on the pitch.
I really like what Lerner's doing at the moment. I like the whole structure of the club. I think Houllier is the right man to have in charge, and unlike the Chelsea deal with Torres, I think the signing of Darren Bent was the key thing your side was lacking in an attempt to move forward. You've brought some great youth players into the club, into the team from the setup there, and what you were lacking really, and John Carew obviously is a good player, but you were lacking a top quality centre forward. And I think the days of Heskey starting for a top eight Premier League team for me should be over, given his age and his somewhat questionable track record in front of goal. And actually, you know, you're not a team that wants to be playing 4-4-2. So you've got Ashley Young, you know, the players you've got in your midfield are perfectly suited to play in the system with a lone striker. And there wasn't another striker available that likes to play up front on his own of even comparable quality to Darren Bent.
He's worth paying for, to be honest. If he, in the short term, scores the goals that keep us up, in the long term, starts to repay some of that fee, then he's absolutely worth it. And he was not the missing piece of the puzzle, as if we're going to go and suddenly, you know, start winning the Champions League. But he was a player who really does plug a huge gap in the team.
Yeah. Put the money exactly where it needed to be.
A couple of things to just finish off on. I mean, I guess, like, one thing, we talk about the Premier League, but the effects have really felt sort of further down the table with those clubs who, in a Championship or even League One, who are investing a lot of money to try and get up there, and when they fall short or when they fall back down again, that's where the problems tend to come out, rather than those clubs that are in the Premier League getting those, even just sixth place year in, year out.
Yeah, I mean, I did some research on a piece about the FA Cup a few months ago, and it was quite staggering the number of teams I saw that had made the semi-finals of the FA Cup over the last 20 years that were now just lingering around in the, not even challenging at the top of the Championship. They're lingering around the bottom of the Championship or down in League One. You know, the Sheffield Wednesdays of this world. It's quite sad to see. You know, even, you know, a team such as Coventry that in the early years of the Premier League were an established Premier League team for a number of years, and if, you know, it's quite scary if you look at the Championship table and the League One table, that both of those leagues have literally got, you know, numerous teams that were previously well-established Premier League teams that spent too much money striving, as Chris says, to try and move forward and take the next step, that really standing still and maintaining your position was actually what was needed at the time.
And I think a lot of Plymouth Argyle fans might have something to say about that as well, which we mentioned last week. One final thought before we move on to the very last thing. I wanted to mention Nottingham Forest ladies, who they've just got to their cup final, but they might fold before there unless they find £5,000 before the end of the month. Chris, I mean, that just kind of says it all, in the disparity between, you know, okay, it's different genders on the sport, but, you know, it's still part of the same sport. That's such a huge disparity between sort of top and the bottom. And I know you can talk about, you know, obviously the bigger clubs, they deserve what they are through earnings and what have you, but when you see so little and just for such small amount not trickling down to that kind of level, yeah, kind of sticks in the craw a bit.
It does. It always strikes me about the sums that are talked about to save non-league clubs as well. We're talking 10, 15 grand in some cases that they need to come up with. And it obviously is quite irritating that can come out of the weekly wages of a Premier League player in most cases, and in some cases without them even noticing.
Especially if it's Jermaine Pennant.
Oh, yeah. So that's... We don't want to be too blasé about the whole thing. Let's take it out of Gattuso's fine.
I mean, I'm fully on side with this idea, you know, trying to get players or the Premier League clubs to contribute. I mean, for me, first and foremost, Nottingham Forest Football Club themselves should have a responsibility to not let that happen. You know, they've got numerous players in there. I'm sure Rob Earnshaw or whoever is on a decent amount of money. They've got enough money in that setup that can't be allowed to happen. And the game of football, on a club-by-club basis, needs to support women's football, so things like that cannot happen.
It's not out of the question that they get promoted this season as well, and if they get promoted in the same season that the women's team dies because of £5,000,
yes,
that's a travesty.
Yeah, scandalous. Let's leave this pod on a happier note. We look back over the career of a true great who has just hung his boots up. Enough about Gary Neville. Chris, just how good was the Brazilian Ronaldo?
I'm not going to say he's the greatest striker of all time. He's certainly the best that I've seen.
Why?
Incredible finishing, great speed in his early career. He managed to adapt his game to reflect his weight. And you know, more to do with the injuries that through whatever happened in them created that weight. And he's just he's changed from being a speedy goal scorer to a bit of a poacher. He scores from distance. He's incredibly skillful. He was just an absolutely superb player.
Mm. And if you look on www.twofootedtackle.com, you'll see Blaise's favourite 11, and you put Ronaldo in there.
I did. He was one of the first names on the team sheet. I found his press conference actually. If you've not seen it, you should try and find it online. I found it quite moving actually watching his press conference. The references he made to his injuries, obviously the revelations he made about his weight, and you could tell it was a from the heart kind of statement from him, and he only went further up in my estimations on that. It's strange actually how certain players you take to, and he has had a number of misdemeanors, shall we say, in his career, which they always kind of came off as more mischievous rather than malicious to me. I don't know whether it was just the toothy grin or what, but I kind of just chuckled, and I can certainly think of a number of Premiership players that may play in blue that if they did a similar thing, I'd want to string them up. But no, one of a kind, and I think it probably says a lot that from what Cristiano Ronaldo's currently bringing to world football, that in 20 years' time, when you say to someone, Ronaldo was a brilliant player, no one will confuse him with Cristiano Ronaldo, irrespective of what he goes on to achieve throughout his, you know, the rest of his career. There will be one Ronaldo.
On the Guardian Football Weekly this week, I had Sid Lowe, when he was talking about Ronaldo, just said, what a pity for his career, because when you think of the injuries he had and what he could have won, we could have possibly, had it not been for the injuries, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say possibly the greatest player.
Yeah, 100 international goals, I don't think would have been out of reach. Even with the injuries he's had, his goals per game ratio is up there, you know, with people from a previous generation, where you normally say, oh, you can't really compare the game in that era with the modern day era. Well, you know, he managed to score at a rate comparable with previous eras. Absolutely fantastic record.
Mm. Chris, one of a kind for you?
Definitely. I can't think of a striker in his mould since his, you know, his real heyday that could even grow to become like him. I think we're generations away from a player of his kind, and by that point, strikers like Ronaldo won't be necessary in the game anyway.
The season at Barcelona, the single season he had there was just staggering. He scored a couple of goals that you see on all his highlight reels, he just had consistent performance throughout that year. But you know, 40 odd goals. I think he was only 21 at the time or something. It was an unbelievable season.
It's like a sad footnote as well that obviously he was at Corinthians at the end of his career and clearly wanted to win the Libertadores, went out very early on, and the fans then sort of protested against him, and he kind of felt it was a very sad footnote to the end of his career.
Yeah, still managed to score 9 goals in 20 games though, so
yeah,
they say a goal every other game is a top level striker, so yeah. Right till the end he still managed to keep performing on the field.
Roberto Carlos on the move as well.
Dagestan.
I think those fans might do me some damage if I played in front of them.
absolutely on there. Yeah, it's a great shame to see him go. And I guess, like, just for people of our generation, he's the big name that we grew up with, and he's the name that we all, you know, looked out for. And he was, I guess, you've got Ronaldo and Messi of this generation, but he was the star of our generation before we left there. And Chris, I'm not wanting to sort of be going back to the football podcast and rival football podcast again, but I was just really struck as well by Fernando Duarte's saying that he thought Romario was better than Ronaldo as well.
He has a case, but I disagree with it.
I think Romario made a great deal out of a lot less talent than Ronaldo maybe had, and I'm sure if Romario had to deal with the injuries that Ronaldo had had, you know, we wouldn't be making statements like that. What he was durable and had a very long career and you know, some fantastic achievements. But actually, what Ronaldo has managed to achieve, given the injuries he's had, is just quite staggering. Most players that have those injuries disappear off and become a footnote. And I hate to say it, you know, a Michael Owen and what could have been, and we're not sitting here without Ronaldo saying what could have been. We're saying what a fantastic career he had.
Mm, exactly. Okay, well, we've left it there with memories. Might even, Chris, if you've got time, find a couple of Ronaldo videos and stick them up with the podcast so we can find all the best.
I'm sure if I remember, I'll have the time to do that.
Yeah. Tweet Chris
on the field videos only.
Yes. Well, unless you do manage to no. Sell that one to Golden Sullivan. It's
a family site.
Okay. Well, that's about it for this week. John, thank you very much for coming
in. An absolute pleasure.
Chris, thank you.
Thank you very much.
A few little plugs to go through. www.twofootatackle.com. Plenty of my favourite 11s on there. Blessings is on there. Theo Delaney's is on there. And that's well worth a read. Especially if you want to see Peter Schmeichel singing about bacon. Various other ones as well. Or all the various stuff that you can find at twofootatackle.com. Facebook.com/twofootatackle if you want to become a fan of the site. Twitter.com/twofootatackle. That's Chris's account if you want to yell him. BetterTheWeek.com.
Dot net.
BetterTheWeek.net. That's Blaise's site on there. And some very good betting tip on there. How much are you actually in profit by this year so far?
Well, this calendar year, not that much, with it being February. I think the site is about 180% up since it began. I kind of aim to make maybe 10% a month. If I can get up towards that, then it's a thinking man's betting website rather than a bog standard betting tips website, and it's very much seen as just making a return on your money higher than you would by having it in a bank account or buying shares or something similar with it. So there's a full results list on the site, so check it out and see if you like it.
Exactly. And you can follow me, twitter.com/GAFootball. I'll probably be talking about sausage rolls and the like, because that's my kind of banter. I said the B word. Well, Chris, I think, kind of punished me. We're not here next week anyway. Chris has just collapsed next to me with use of that word. We're not here next week because we're off to Socrates. So we'll be back in 2 weeks' time, where our guest is Chris Lyons from Narrow the Angle. Take care. See you then.
Twofootedtackle.com.